Hey there, CNF buddies. I'm coming at you live from my shiny new digs. New house up in Eugene, and I've got a nice little office I can call my own. Not a cloffice like I had in my last place, a hybrid office closet. No. An actual office with a window and lamps. There's no foam on the walls yet, so please pardon the audio, but we're making strides to be the best, and part of that is me shutting the front door and getting the hell out of the way. I still haven't quite figured out how to completely edit myself out of these interviews, but I'm working on it. Don't you worry. Rachel Corbett, she joins me this week for episode 88 of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak with the world's best artists about creating works of nonfiction, leaders in the world of narrative journalism, essay, memoir, radio, and documentary film, where I try and tease out origins, habits, routines, mentors, key influences, so you can apply some of their tools of mastery to your own work. Rachel is a freelance journalist whose work appears in a few rags you might have heard of, The New Yorker, The New York Times, etc. She's also the author of You Must Change Your Life, the story of Rainer Maria Rilke and Auguste Rodin. She is at Rachel N. Corbett on the Twitters. Rachel hits on some key points about carving out your own niche, how things come easier when you stop trying so hard, listening versus talking, getting away from the work so you can come back refreshed, and the power of being dumb and defeated. Some of us were born this way. Stay tuned to the end of the show for some incentivized calls to action. In the meantime, here's my conversation with the brilliant Rachel Corbett. But certainly before we get to that, something that really struck me in the introduction of the book was that you had really no intent on becoming a writer. So before we unpack that a little bit, I want to maybe ask you, you know, what did you think you wanted to be when you were younger and coming up?
When I was young, I didn't really know. I would say, I think I wanted to be a doctor, actually. Uh-huh. It wasn't really until I went to college, and I studied like psychology, so I wasn't really in the arts or into writing at all. I thought about maybe going to law school. I wanted to do some kind of like, something kind of activist. I wanted to go into maybe like public policy or advocacy or some kind of, I wanted to work with women. It was until after, quite a while after, until the end of college that I ever considered writing.
Yeah. And what was that moment like where you made that pivot, where something clicked in your head that was like, oh, this is the direction I'd rather go in?
I had this teacher, this professor in college, and I was finishing college, and I was sitting with her and having like a kind of like end of the year meeting, and she said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I don't know. I'm thinking about moving away. I really just wanted to leave Iowa. And I said, I might just move to Chicago or something, or Minneapolis, and get a job and figure it out. And she said, well, you're a good writer. Why don't you go to New York? And you can intern for a magazine or something, and you could write for Harper's or The New Yorker or something, she said. And that was kind of mind blowing. I never thought about that before. Mm. So I did. I just didn't know what to do. I was really aimless. So I did and I got an internship at this like little like kind of political news, kind of women's news website. And they were great because they paid like $9 an hour or something, which was amazing for an internship. Right. And at the time, and then I just stayed in New York. I got another internship, and then I went to grad school, and then, you know, finally started getting work in writing.
What was the name of that website?
It was called Women's E-News. Mm-hmm. It's still around. It's great, actually. They just do kind of like, it's very small. They publish like a couple stories a day, just about, it's very global, kind of women's health issues, politics around the world.
And as you, you know, arrive in New York and get this internship, what was your experience with, you know, writing articles, and what were some of your early, you know, for lack of a better term, like growing pains as you were looking to, you know, craft stories for this website?
Well, I think at that point it was just figuring out how to not write term papers and how to write journalism, right. You know, cause I was right out of school. So it wasn't, I didn't really know. And also I think I was still figuring out, whether I wanted to be kind of in advocacy or in journalism. I didn't really understand the difference at that point. So this was a kind of in between venue because it was, they did real journalism, but it was, you know, it had obviously its own kind of political agenda in the sense that it was focused on women and it had, you know, a kind of progressive view. So I think for me, it was sort of figuring out whether I wanted to really go into maybe like the nonprofit world or really go into journalism and writing, which would mean kind of taking a different, kind of putting my politics in the backseat a bit more, I think. Mm-hmm. And that was a kind of a defining moment for me, realizing that I kind of had to choose. And I'm happy that I did in the end, but I'm happy that I did go the way I went. But it was, yeah, I think that was, it wasn't immediately obvious to me. I think that happens with a lot of young people when they're starting out, you know, it's very hard to be a good opinion writer. And I think it's something you have to really develop, and not everyone can go in with a point of view.
Yeah. And I think with a lot of, or maybe a misconception with a lot of opinion writing is that there, that it is just simply hot takes and that there isn't a whole lot of research or reporting that can go into something that's an opinion based. So some people probably think that they can just go in and just be a blowhard in a sense, but like truly great opinion writing actually is founded in superior reporting. And was that your sense that like when you had to develop a repertorial muscle?
Yeah, exactly. Because it doesn't read that way. You know, like the best writing, of course, reads like it's very easy. And like, it's like they just had all these facts in their head, you know, and they're just great arguers. But of course, you realize, you know, when you try to write that way, it doesn't turn out so well if you don't do all that research. So that was, I think, for me, you know, that's why I went to journalism school. And I think it was partially to develop exactly what you're talking about there. Some kind of support system. I didn't feel good enough as a writer yet, I guess, to mm-hmm. be that, you know, and I think that's also why I didn't write fiction, because I didn't feel like I had enough in me alone, you know, with just my thoughts. I kind of always needed to draw from the world, the research. So,
and you went to Columbia School of Journalism?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And so when you got there, what did you feel like were your strengths and your weaknesses as a budding journalist?
So, sort of the same. They're kind of two sides of the same coin, I would say. One is like, I didn't know that you could just basically call people on the phone and they would tell you. You can ask them questions and they'll tell you things and they'll answer you. And it's very simple, but I lacked that sense of entitlement, I think. And it was really useful for me for that reason. It's something that maybe not everyone needs to go to journalism school for, but for me, it was kind of powerful just to realize that you can just go places and ask people things and then they'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. And so that was like, I guess, my weakness going in. But also on the other side of that, I was pretty impressionable and pretty open-minded. It was all kind of amazing to me. And so I think I was a kind of good journalist because I was very receptive and I didn't have a lot of, I was so kind of, I was also like 20 at this point. So I didn't have any, you know, I really wanted to tell other people's stories. I didn't have anything. I didn't have a real agenda, of my own. So I think I was really kind of a sponge in a way that was maybe useful.
Did you struggle at first when you were, say, interviewing people in power, and then having not to be adversarial, but to be to pick up that phone and be somewhat forceful and not combative, but you know, you do have to sometimes push back, and that's a weakness I have. I tend to just let people talk, and I have a tendency to just, let them talk and not really push back much because I'm just kind of listening. So I wonder, where you fell on that and how you developed your sort of your interviewing chops and repertorial chops on that spectrum.
Yeah, I'm the same as you. I think it just took practice and kind of like nerve to push people on topics. Though, it can also be, there's something to be said for like, there is some advantage to saying nothing and just letting people go forever. Yeah. Eventually they fill the silences, with information and things that they might not otherwise say if you were really kind of directing them. So, I think there's benefits to both sides.
Yeah. I know, I'm just not a press conference type reporter interviewer,
you have to
elbow your way in or that kind of, it just doesn't appeal to my taste. And so is that the same case with you?
Yeah, it's terrifying. I don't like to do interviews in front of a group of people either. Like, I don't want to publicly, I don't want to shout my questions over a room that's hard. Or, under that kind of pressure, you get one chance or something. It's definitely nicer to have a conversation with somebody in private.
What did you gravitate towards, I guess, as you were diving deeper into your grad school studies? And how did your tastes evolve and change? And then, and how did you ultimately pick the course of journalism that you're on now?
I wish it was a better story, but it was a little bit practical. Because when I finished, it was 2007, and it was right when all the media companies were starting to lay off. Condé Nast was gutting jobs, and it was right before the economy collapsed. And so there just wasn't any work. And I was thinking about moving to Arkansas or a place like this to go work for one of the all weeklies, but then they started closing too. So then I thought, well, I might as well stick it out in New York. And it seemed to be that the only places that were doing okay or were still hiring were these like higher end magazines, like luxury magazines and like fashion or lifestyle or art. So I got a job at one of these magazines and started an arts column there just to kind of make it more pleasant for myself. Mm-hmm. It was a kind of a fashion, lifestyle, food, travel, whatever. And they didn't have much visual art coverage. So I started that. And then I was kind of started freelancing on the side for art magazines. I think maybe Art News was one of the first ones, because they were a more journalistic focused one. And I always just felt like there was a need for, more accessible arts writing. And also there were also places like that who it seemed like always needed good writers who were not necessarily, who could write in an accessible way. And also, I think writers were not going that direction because they were intimidated sometimes by art or just by the content. So it seemed like there was a kind of a space that needed to be filled. And I kind of found a little niche for myself in there between kind of art and journalism.
Yeah. And were you always drawn to the art scene and you felt like that was a niche you could dive into, or did you recognize it as a niche and you sort of were like, all right, well, that's a place where I can take my writing skills and make my own niche?
Yeah, it's a little of both. I mean, it was kind of practical. I really did feel like there was a need for somebody and a kind of opportunity just professionally, but also I don't know what it was. I think, my brother is an artist, And my dad was a kind of, you know, an amateur artist. And I think it just was something I felt comfortable around. And a lot of my friends have always been artists. So I don't really know why it happened, but it was definitely of, you know, I wanted to, I can't explain exactly why. I think it was both practical and it just felt very natural. I don't know what else to say about it. Mm-hmm. I wish I had like a clear, like, you know, trajectory, but I don't really know.
And so how does, because it is on its surface, it feels hard to get into and hard to understand, and people who want to educate themselves more might feel a little insecure that they're going to sound foolish or missing a fundamental element of understanding art or high art. So how have you been able to convey what it is in as you said, like a very accessible way to a reader that then they might be able to graduate to like higher discussions and higher discourse when it comes to talking about, you know, sculpture or painting or poetry?
Well, two things. Like, one is that, like, when I started doing the journalism, it was the art world also had, like, every aspect of a story you would want. It had, like, there was money and power, and then you have characters with the artists, you have visual things to describe. It was, the whole scene was great for any journalist, really. But in terms of, like, actually talking about art, and making it, you know, I think it's really just, it's a matter of simplifying the process a little bit. Like, I think a lot of writers try to write about the ideas and try to tell you what things mean before they've really looked at something. And so I think it's like, if you really start out and like, and really accept that you're kind of dumb when you look at something, mm-hmm. and like, and just sort of humble yourself in that way, then I think you could be kind of start to then describing it, writing about it is the way to just to kind of start to look at it or to understand the, you know, whatever the object is. Mm. And then you can kind of start to draw conclusions. But I think it's really just allowing yourself to kind of be dumb and defeated before when you start, and then moving from there.
That's the story of my life, Rachel. Just right? Dumb and defeated.
Me too. I don't know. It works. Whatever works.
Do you recall like the a first sort of illuminating moment when you went from dumb and defeated before a piece of art, and then you really start were able to unpack it and crack its code. Did you have a particular piece and a moment around that?
Mm. Oh, that's a hard question. I mean, probably, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the same way with poetry, you know, I think when you kind of try to dissect it line by line, you know, so that's, I feel like that's also the whole theme of this book, basically, you know, is how to look at something and let it kind of open you up, let it kind of change the way you think. So I think in terms of, I'm trying to think of like a particular example. I did it a lot with Rodins, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to describe those, mm-hmm. in the process of writing this. So going to like the Philadelphia Museum or something, there's a Rodin Museum in Philadelphia. Things like the man with the broken nose, or some of his hand sculptures, could spend a lot of time because they're also so kind of narratively driven. You know, his figures are so, you know, they have so much drama in them that you can really kind of spend a lot of time imagining the stories.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that something that is static by its very nature is actually incredibly kinetic if you just stare at it long enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's like, that was certainly what he really wanted to convey more than anything, probably, is that sense of a kind of a movement or a kind of inner turmoil or a striving towards something. So that was definitely his project, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, in the introduction to the book, you know, you have this moment where your mother hands you letters to a young poet. And what was that exchange like, and how illuminating was it to then be reading through that book and then to ultimately realize it was a book that was gifted to your mother at a similar age?
It was like the perfect time to read it. Like, that was the perfect age and the perfect circumstance. And I don't know if it would be the same if I were to read it now. It might be too old now, but I think it was, I'd never really heard of it, but it's exactly like, you know, it's like less than 100 pages. It's very short. It's very accessible in its way. And I was just like, I don't know what it is. It just turns, it just makes, like, it's that for that age where you don't, you're everything is a little bit undecided, and you have this kind of aimless will towards something. Like, you know, you have all this desire, you have all this like longing to do something, but you have no direction, like no place to put it. And it kind of, I just felt like that book really puts you at ease. It kind of says it's okay to not know. It's okay to not have answers, to not have money, to not have the anything, to be alone, to be completely you know, without anything. And so I think at that age, when you really feel like you have nothing figured out, it's just the perfect, it's very comforting. And she was actually given to it by, she had this boyfriend who was leaving the country, like he was taking a job out of the country, and he gave her this book when he was leaving. Mm-hmm. And she had never read it before. And so she read it then, and she just thought it resonated with her. And so she, when I was finishing school, I think I was just finishing college, and I was just like lost and trying to figure out where to move, she gave me that book. And I, you know, never expected my mother to give me a book that I would like, but it was amazing. I read it like 4 times immediately. And then I kept reading it every, maybe, couple of years. I still have it.
And did you find that, you know, reading that book, it allowed you to cultivate a certain sense of patience with your own work and your own career, that if you just kind of put in the work, that good things would eventually come to you?
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird, I don't know how much like actual practical advice there was in that book. I don't know if I really carried it with me, but it's definitely comforting, like in your, you know, most direst, most dramatic moment, like emotional moments. There's something very comforting about it, but I don't know that I really understood what, I mean, I think the real lesson of what he says is basically just to kind of keep working, and eventually if you're good enough, something will come. I mean, it's not very, and to be alone and to, you know, provide yourself the conditions in which you can work. This is sort of the main messages of Letters to a Poet. But I think it was more like in moments of despair, I would like, we could flip it open and it would tell you that like your despair was exactly the correct feeling to have at that moment. So, so embrace it. And that was kind of, so it was more like in those kind of moments that I found it to be useful.
And Rilke was he was starving for a mentorship. But did you find it odd that a poet would seek someone in another discipline as his prime mentor?
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, he had tried to find other writers. He had sought out Leo Tolstoy in Russia, and George Simmel, the writer and philosopher in Germany. And of course, his other great mentor is Lou Andreas Salomé, the writer. So he had had a lot of literary mentors. But I think that Rodin was very particular for him, and the influence was so great because it was a different medium, and because he really envied sculptors. His wife was also a sculptor, And he really wanted to make, he envied that they could make real objects that sat in the world. And he always felt like poetry was a sort of lesser form because it was intangible. And he thought that the highest, you know, if certain poets could, like Baudelaire could, make sculptural type poems at least. And that was what he wanted. So he felt like studying sculpture would be the closest way to figuring out how to make his poetry have more weight, basically, or more structure. He had always had he was kind of coming out of this German romantic style at the time when he was very young, and he was much more sentimental. And so he really took a full kind of 180 and started, he stopped kind of writing about human feelings and started writing about objects in this attempt to kind of create objects through writing about them.
One of the questions I always like to ask people I have on the show is, like, what other artistic media do you consume to help inform your writing or whatever your main vocation is? What thing do you do differently to help inform that? And it's kind of like, you know, Rilke was doing that by looking at sculptures. Like, how can I make my poetry look like that statue? And that's kind of a, like, maybe a good lesson for anyone to maybe look outside your discipline to make your own discipline better.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it has to do with just that process of observation, less about what it is you're looking at and more about that kind of careful study of how it was made. And then once you really understand how that thing was made step by step, you can kind of, that close attention, I think, is the best lesson, and you can kind of understand how things are done. And I think that's really what, you know, I think he could have probably done it with music, or he could have probably done it with dance. I don't know. You know, it just happened to be sculpture in this case.
Rodin was very much, it was like work, always work. So maybe it was one of those things where, you know, you might idolize, or, oh, you look at someone's finished products and you think it just came into being. But maybe Rodin, like, grounded a sense of work ethic and rigor in Rilke, in a sense. And also, like, to us, the reader, that is just like, yeah, you know, ultimately it's, you just got to sit down and do the work somehow. And, you know, how illustrative that can be. And then the final product will speak for itself. But it is an ugly process that eventually elicits beauty. But you have to be willing to deal with those ugly middles.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's well put. And he, you know, he had like his Rodin's, you know, example was like to be like, they were sitting together one day by the pond or something, and Rodin plucked a mushroom from the ground and turned it over, and he showed Rilke all the gills on the underside of the mushroom, and he was like, see that? That's good work. Or cathedrals. He really loved the Gothic cathedrals because he felt they were like really a testament to the power of labor and you know, one brick on top of the next for hundreds of years. That was to him like the highest form of artistic achievement. Something that, you know, where you can see the, you know, it results in something completely different. The transformation happens through kind of a tedious process. And that was certainly what he taught Rilke to do, you know, to start small with a mushroom or a rock or a leaf or whatever, and to describe it. And then from there, you know, something that whatever the magical transformation into art that happens naturally kind of along the way. Whereas, you know, that's why you can't start on the other side. You can't start with the meaning, or you can't start with the artistic message you want to convey. You kind of have to start and then with a simple thing, and then you discover it along the way.
In your own writing, in your own practice of writing, did you, you know, have similar moments of elucidation of when it was, I don't know, you know, whatever influential books that you had, and you saw those finished products, and, you know, as you were starting to get to your own finished products, did you have those like a moment of a eureka moment that, oh yeah, like it was work for them. It's work for me. I just have to endure and persevere, and then I can get to something that's very fully formed at the end, you know, sort of like, you know, Rodan yeah. picking up the mushroom and be like, oh, this is good work, but you know, you got to grind through it.
Yeah. Well, that's writing a book, isn't it? Like that's the whole thing. That's the whole, I mean, that was my experience all the way, kind of, you know, just like, it was just a process of frustrations. I think, you know, I think of, it just was like I would just spend every day in the library and just kind of, you know, you put down all the facts because it's nonfiction, so everything has to be correct and careful. And then you kind of sit with them, and then you think, all right, what is this? Have I just written a timeline? Have I written anything of use here? Like, what is this? What do I do with it? And then there's these kind of moments of doubt and frustration, like maybe this is not going anywhere. Maybe there's nothing creative about this at all. And then, you know, it happens. I don't, you know, eventually, you know, that there were plenty of those moments that I don't really know. It's hard to tie to anything. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, it's usually when you stop, you know, it's usually when you stop trying so hard.
Right.
Like something happens.
Yeah. You just got to get unbridled and just let it rip.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or it's like kind of when you get, if there's so much about it that's uncreative, you know, like just like the when you're like, for me, I always put down like all of the, I just make sure all the facts are correct. So I'd always do that first. And it's so kind of hollows you out. It's just really tedious and really boring kind of. And, it's useful. You learn your subjects, but in that process, you can kind of, it's, you have to go away for a few days and then come back and then look at it fresh, I think. And then maybe you'll see what's actually kind of magical about this information, you know?
In those moments when you had to, say, go away for a few days, what would you do in that time to help recharge yourself so you can come back to the work fresh?
Well, I would just try to do something completely different, like not think about it at all. Go, I mean, I would have probably, you know, when I was writing it, I was also working, so I would go, maybe I would go work, you know, do a story about whatever, something, you know, for some magazine, and then just put it away completely and then come back, you know, a couple days later. I would just try to segment the days so that they were completely different. One was purely the book and one was purely maybe a magazine story or something.
And how do you keep track of that and schedule your days so you can make the most of it when it is, say, book day versus magazine deadline day? Like, do you have a particular practice so you can keep things straight?
Yeah, I just plan it out ahead of time. I just try to decide like which days will be which, and I usually change locations. like I would do, like I would always work. I would go to the Columbia Library usually when I would work on the book because it's quiet and you know, I can't get phone calls and stuff. So, and then when I'm writing for, you know, doing journalism, it would be, I'd work at home or I'd work at an office or depending on, you know, if I would go into the magazine or whatever, or so that usually like the whole structure of the day would be different. And I just try to plan one so that the other doesn't interrupt the other, you know, it's just two different ways of thinking. So it's usually not too hard to separate them out.
Yeah. And one thing that really struck me when I was reading the book was how, you know, Rilke, he, at one point, I think it was when he was kind of, he couldn't get a toehold with the right mentor. And so he designed his own syllabus of study, which I thought was really brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it's something that like anyone can do today. Sort of like you can make your own MFA if you want, like save the money. And just go find the people you want to be like and read their shit and study their stuff.
But his was hilarious.
Yeah.
Because his was like learn Danish and like learn more about the celestial body, like learn more natural history, like learn the origin of stars. Like his was so, they were huge.
Yeah, I love that so much. And I thought that was like such a great way to sort of seize your own study and be as self-made as you can. And something that really stuck in my head. And I wonder, as you were doing your research and as an artist who works in true stories, and these were also artists you were studying in different media, what did you learn and take away from studying them that maybe you were able to say, like, oh, that's cool, I'm going to steal that and apply it to my own work?
Certainly, like, I mean, I didn't, what I do like from what his idea was when he was making that syllabus was to actually not include any literature in it. So it was a syllabus basically to broaden his horizons, to learn other things. So I thought that was actually really useful. So he would, you know, it would be, you know, the closest he would come would be maybe to learn about architecture or something. And I think that's really useful to kind of, you all the time have to read if you're a writer, but, and I all the time I'm looking at art, but I think I learned a lot about like, history and the, you know, when I was working on this about the architecture in Paris and the way the city was constructed, and about psychology and the history of how the influence between like aesthetic philosophy and psychology and the origins of Darwinism, and these were all like ideas that were completely relevant to the artistic scene at the time, but you don't necessarily associate them together now, or you wouldn't naturally do it. So I think there was a real, I mean, he was absolutely right that, you know, studying Darwin had everything to do with, or Nietzsche had everything to do with understanding the kind of the literary circles too, because everything's coming out of the same culture. So for me, I also read a lot of Nietzsche and Darwin and all the philosophers of the time, because I don't think it was just that time period, but these ideas were all commingling and creating the whole culture that I was trying to write about. So I think that's a good, actually a very good lesson.
Yeah, and something else in your book too, you talk a lot about the artists, the female artists in Westhoff, Becker, and they're, unfortunately, they're fairly tragic lives, because at that time, you know, Rodin is saying that women in your lives are manipulative and will smother your art. And so these women who are very talented in their own right were silenced in a lot of ways and not allowed to express themselves to their fullest potential. And, you know, given your start as, you know, writing for, you know, Women's E-News and having that that bent as a journalistic entry into your writing career, what was it like for you to tell their stories and, you know, in this sort of in this climate too?
Yeah, I was a little conscious that I was writing a story about two kind of, you know, old dead white men, and like at a time when it's, you know, not necessarily, I mean, it, you know, not something that needed to be done necessarily, but it didn't matter to me. I wanted to do this story, but I think in a way, a comment that I get a lot since it came out is that is about the women characters, and people tell me a lot that they are really happy that they feel like full characters, especially Paula Becker and Clara Westhoff, and that's of course makes me very happy, because I think it was really hard to find information on them. Not so much Paula, because she's quite celebrated, but or also Rodin's wife. There was just, because they weren't famous, there's not a lot written about them, but it was important to me to make them whole, because, you know, as dismissive as Rodin was of women, certainly Rilke was not. He always was with extremely accomplished women, and he always admired them and looked up to them and sought them as both kind of mentors and lovers. So it didn't seem possible to really tell his story without telling his wife's, yeah, or Lulu Salome, you know. So it was a lot more work in a way, because I had to really dig to find stuff about a lot of them. But I think it's worth it in the end because they do, I hope, become real people. And I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a woman. There's something just kind of naturally inclined to make them human in the book.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
It was,
I mean, it wasn't conscious.
It was a great addition. Those are some of the parts of the books that I felt really popped because it departed from the two main figures, and you realize that there were these other influential people, and you got a sense of, you know, sort of their desperation for visibility and artistic fame, but they were just kind of always in the shadows, unfortunately.
It's tragic. Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, they all have kind of sad endings too, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, Paula Becker died tragically young, and Camille Claudel ended up in an asylum, and Claire Vestoff, you know, got kind of stuck raising the kid and, you know, had a career, but not the one she wanted to have, you know.
Yeah.
So it doesn't. Lou Salome, maybe she's the kind of one silver lining, you know.
Yeah.
She got to
swim with Freud and got and all that. And that's another wonderful element of the book too, is that, like, you know, Freud kind of plays into this whole thing. Is that like them and also the women's stories, were those elements of the book things that surprised you as you dive deeper into the research?
Yeah, totally. I had no idea about the connection between Freud and Rilke. That was completely a shock to me, and it's still not even completely confirmed. I mean, there's this essay that Freud wrote about a walk that he took with his a poet, and it's assumed by a lot of scholars that poet was Rilke, though it's not 100% confirmed. But I never knew that, and I knew that this sort of nascent science of the self that was happening at the time was part of Rilke's story, because he wrote about that, and he wrote about it it infused his own work, and he himself thought about going into psychoanalysis, as a patient, not as a doctor, and he had his dreams analyzed for a while, so I knew that there was some relationship between the kind of origins of psychology in Rilke's life, but I didn't know that he had such direct contact with Freud, and that, you know, and that through Lou Salome, he would have, you know, he kind of rejected psychoanalysis. He decided, he thought it would this kind of romantic view that if you underwent psychoanalysis, it would cure you of both the angels and the demons. So he might become happier, but it would also take away his creative powers. So he didn't fully submit to the doctrine, but he was able to take from it here and there through Lou, who was a student of Freud's and also became the analyst of one of Freud's daughters. So you see how it plays a lot into Rilke's later life.
Mm. And as you were looking to... as you were crafting the book, and even maybe before you got to writing it, did you have any example or model books that you were like, okay, this is what I've read, and this will help sort of inform the structure and the sort of this co-biography angle I'm looking for? Were there any influential books that helped you along the way?
Yeah, well... The co-biography, I'm trying to think of it. I mean, I read a lot of biographies. I'm trying to think of what I read specifically, like a dual one. I mean, I certainly read a lot about Rilke. You know, I read and Rodin, of course. I really loved William Gass's Reading Rilke, which I'd actually read long before I started this project. Because it's really this dance between kind of philosophical musings and a dissection of the ways of the way different poetry is translated. And he lines up different translations side by side and then takes them apart and kind of shows you how they come to be. And also a kind of close reading of, of Rilke's life kind of told through the poetry. And I that book was always, that really stuck with me. And, you know, I read it many times. Of course, I read it again when I was working on this project, because it had that kind of, that bit of everything in it. So it wasn't like a, you know, it certainly wasn't a dual biography, but it showed you how to kind of put together different, all the different elements of a life, the creative part, the critical part of, you know, looking at the work. And then, of course, just questioning yourself as an author. You know, his, that whole book is him sort of questioning the different problems of translation. And I don't read German, so this is something I was kind of coming against a lot, and doubting myself and questioning how I should approach interpreting certain poems or talking about them. So for me, that book was probably the most important. And it's the kind of unlikely model. I don't know if I had like a good, I had like a real model. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I read that, you know, there were just a lot of, you know, I really liked, Jeff Dyer had written a really nice essay about the two of them, about Rilke and Rodin, and also about the relationship of kind of, I think it's called genius envy. It's about, and he looks at other kinds of, joint of figures like this. I can't remember who the other ones are off the top of my head, but two people where they kind of, two creative, you know, stars that kind of how they influence each other and how they maybe envy each other and the push and pull between their relationships. And that was, I think, also important to me at the time.
Yeah. And is there a writer or two out there where you, that you admire to like, to the extent that like Rilke admired Rodin, and someone that you like just achieved to be, or you know, achieved to be is a weird way of saying it, but someone like you aspire to be, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, God, there's a lot of them. It's so funny because it's like, in different ways, I think a lot of the books that I loved before, you know, like certainly, you know, I think William Gass is one of the great thinkers that I loved during these last few years. But before that, I always really liked writers. I think I always liked writers who had really good senses of place. And I loved like Annie Proulx or Cormac McCarthy or Michael Gilmore. They always wrote about kind of landscapes like the one I came from, and I think those, oddly enough, were the ones that I you know, I wanted to be like, you know, they always, you know, if I read something recently about how if you look like the subjects that writers are drawn to are often the same subjects that they were interested in before they were like 20 years old or before they're 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of, and I find myself often I find that to be true, the same, you know, maybe that's why Letters to Young Poet worked for me. It was such a, was such an important catalyst for this book, because I read it at that formative age. And so I think like those writers who come from places like I did and write about the places like I come from, that I'm always drawn to them. So I would say those three and William Gass.
Mm-hmm. What are... When you're in that mode of doing something extensively big as the book, and how do you set up your days so you can accomplish the work? And I know you say you like mapped out, you know, like X day is book day, blah blah. But on a day-to-day basis, how do you set up your day so you feel sort of victorious when the sun goes down?
Well, that's, I don't know, that's a really good day. You know, well, I go far away, you know, it's like an hour from where I live. I go far away so that I'm there really for the whole day and there's nothing else to do. And then I sit there for like an hour usually, you know, I'm good like in the morning. I like to start very early, first thing in the morning. And I think clearly, I try to write a little bit, and then I get tired of writing, and so then I read a little bit, or I'd kind of do research, and then and like go distract myself by eating something or whatever. I mean, it's so boring. I don't know if this is like the least interesting thing to talk about in a way, but and then you work a little more. I don't think it's very often that I feel victorious, but unless you've had one of those really great, rare moments of, you know, kind of.
Yeah, I guess maybe in lieu of victorious would be like accomplished, you know, like, all right,
this yeah. is,
you know, I hit my word count for the day or page count or.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like maybe a better way to say is like after you've set up your day, like how do you measure what it means to have had a good day?
I think it's like if something, a new idea came on. Yeah, I don't have like a word count goals really. Maybe I should, but I don't really have that. So I kind of, you know, hopefully I, you know, move, hopefully something moved, you know, I got from one place to another, something was put down and then like some new ideas came about where to go next, you know, or some like some little offshoots formed that maybe I could explore that I didn't know were going to be there first. So, you know, probably a little combination of that. Just a little movement, I would say, is good. That's an accomplished day.
How do you manage distractions or when you're a little fatigued from maybe the writing or the research, and you know, how do you avoid going down social media rabbit holes and stay focused? Do you have any sort of practice you like to employ?
That's a real problem for me, and I would love to know advice from you or your other writers on that, because I haven't figured that one out yet. I'm really bad. I'm increasingly bad. I don't know. It used to be, I mean, I would say that I guess part of it is I go to the library so that I don't have like domestic distractions. I don't have like, you know, things to clean or, you know, laps around my apartment or something, you know, or like doing chores. That's part of it. But then the distractions of the internet are really hard for me because I haven't figured out a way. I haven't figured out a way to work without the internet yet because I do a lot of research on it. And so I would like to figure out a way maybe to turn it off and just make notes of things I want to look up later and then turn it back on and look things up and then go back and fill in the blanks, you know, because otherwise the problem is I look things up immediately all the time and then I do distract myself. I'm going to go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, I think I've heard Neil Strauss talk about a particular app. Oh, maybe it's called Free or something. But what it does is you set up, say, a 90-minute window, and it will block your computer's capacity to connect to the internet.
Yeah.
It's something that it's forceful. It's not like just turning your Wi-Fi off. Like, it will not let you do it. So as he's writing, you know, if there's something he needs to check, or he'll make a note, be like, okay, when I'm back to internet time, this is what I can look up. So maybe that's something smart. Worth looking into.
Yeah. Have you tried that?
I have not. But
I should try it. Okay. I'll look that up. I definitely, it's time to do something like that. Serious.
Very nice. Well, you know, with Rachel, with respect to your time, I'll let you get going. Let you get out of here by just asking where people can find more about you and your work, and you know, You Must Change Your Life and so forth.
Oh yeah, well, my website has everything on there. It's rachel-corbett.com, and I have like you know, you can, there's reviews and events. You know, I do some talks about the book here and there. So there's more information there, I would say, is the best place. And then, of course, you can buy it on Amazon or Indie Seller, whatever. I think that's the name of the indie book seller online. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you most active on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook?
Yeah, I have all of that. I try to be active. I mean, my Instagram is basically just pictures of the art that I see on a weekly basis. It's, you know, that's either great or boring, depending on your taste. I'm on Twitter too. It's at Rachel N. Corbett.
And so we've come to the end. Big thanks to Rachel Corbett, Rachel N. Corbett on Twitter. If you've made it this far, this is where I will ask you to kindly leave an honest review or rating on iTunes. Ratings take 10 seconds. Reviews take a little bit longer, but here's the thing. If you do that and you show me evidence of it, I will gladly either edit a piece of your work of up to 2,000 words or provide you a transcript for any single episode of the podcast. So if you really liked my conversation with Lee Gutkind on, episode 60, you will get that transcript with hyperlinks and all sorts of goodies in there. Also, I have this really great monthly newsletter that seems to be growing every month, at least the subscription base. The newsletter stays about the same size. It is a little nonfiction digest of books that I recommend, as well as some documentary film and radio or podcasts. So it's a great little thing to give you some things to chew on for a month. So it's once a month, no spam, and you can't beat that. That's at BrendanOmara.com. That's going to do it, friends. Until we do this again next week, have a CNF and great week. Thanks for listening.